Welcome back to a brand new series of Not Too Busy to Write. I'm Penny Winsor, author and book coach, and I am thrilled to be back in your ears. The podcast has hit a couple of milestones since I've been on break. We are now 5 years in, which I cannot quite believe, and have over 100 episodes with the most incredible authors from all kinds of genres and backgrounds, from huge bestsellers and household names to debuts and independent presses, poets, memoirists, literary fiction, crime, romance, nonfiction of all kinds, you name it, we have had an author on talking about it. It has been such a pleasure bringing these conversations to you, and I hope they've helped your writing life as much as they've helped mine. Today, I'm in conversation with Jodie Wilson, author of A Brain That Breathes, Essential Habits for an Overwhelming World. I have long been a fan of Jodie's work, writing online and in books about what it means to live a simple and fulfilling life. So it was an absolute pleasure to have this conversation. After writing 3 books in 3 years, Jodie was feeling pretty depleted and deeply curious about what it takes for a brain to be able to create and what each of us need to be productive as writers. What she discovered was a massive disconnect between the life our brains were designed for and the realities of modern life today. This book is all about bridging that gap in really accessible ways. Jodie talks with me about creative writing as a practice of listening to and sitting with the self, the curious magic and also the grind of writing books, and the uncertainty and doubt that makes up a writing life. We get very deep into time and time for writers as well, which is one of my favorite topics. A Brain That Breathes is out now, and there is a link in the show notes. Enjoy the episode. Jodie, thank you so much for being with me today.
Oh, Penny, it's such an honour to be here. I've listened to your voice for so many years now, so I'm quite excited to be here.
I want to begin by asking you about something that you write about in A Brain That Breathes, is this idea that it's possible to have a slow life and still be ambitious, to live slow, but also live big at the same time. And I want to kind of ask you about that first. What does that look like to you?
So I live on an island at the very bottom of Australia. Lutruwita is the Indigenous name. Tasmania is the English name. And we came to live here after selling 80% of what we owned and traveling Australia in a caravan for a few years, my partner and our 4 children. And that journey really proved to us that you don't need a lot to live well. And for someone that had always been a really high achiever and a perfectionist and the firstborn daughter, that trip really helped me unravel a lot of my anxiety and my expectations, and it really grounded me. And I knew I couldn't go back to a life where it cost us so much just to live. And so, that is an issue across Australia, the housing crisis, and I know it exists in the UK as well. And we know that the cost of living directly impedes and impacts our ability to create. It's all connected, isn't it? So choosing to live on an island where there's very distinct seasons, which is not something that is normal in a lot of Australia. But I love those distinct seasons and the seasonality that they inspire and the way I respond to them. I just felt a really strong sense of belonging here when we first came here. And so when we first arrived here, I got my first book deal. And that's something that I had really always had in my mind as something that I wanted to achieve. But I became a mum at a very young age. I was 22 when I fell pregnant with my first child. And there wasn't a lot of space in early motherhood for my writing work as well. And any mother understands that innate juggle. But now I'm so glad that I had that experience of mothering the 4 children. And I was writing online, but I kind of grew into the writer I am today with a confidence and a self-assuredness that has really benefited me. And so island life is particularly slow. There's a lot of space here. And I can step away from my desk and immediately be slowed by the ocean that's just at the end of the street. And Tasmania is a very understated place. Like, no one has ever once asked me what I do. That question is never asked because people do not judge you based on what you do. They judge you on who you are as a person and how you're conversing with them. It's just not a thing. No one really cares. Yeah. Understated in the way we dress, understated in the way we talk about our careers, understated in the way we chat with each other. And so I've now written 4 books in 4 years. It's been a really intense professional and creative period for me with a lot of lessons learnt. And I actually recorded another interview this morning, and the interviewer was kind of really gushing and saying, "I just cannot believe I get to talk to you." And I it was so sweet, but I was just like, I'm just a really normal, ordinary person. And I really just appreciate very simple things in life. And my life from the outside probably looks quite small to a lot of people. Like, there aren't a lot of restaurant dinners or dressing up and going out. And I really believe that I write from my heart, and it feels like a very instinctive process. And so I'm not always striving. And now that I'm considering what the next project may be, I'm in that space, you know, where a book has just come out and I'm considering what's next. I know that I just have to hold these ideas very tenderly and very gently, and that there's no point rushing it. And I suppose that I can live slow and simply, and also achieve what I have achieved, because I do have that space in my life. And I'm really aware of what my brain and my body needs in order to be grounded and to be well and to continue to come up with bright ideas. And I know that my nervous system especially could not thrive, or I could not thrive creatively, if my nervous system was always on edge, like it probably would be if I lived in a city. And so this is the balance that's right for me, that ability. Perhaps the success is only because of the slow and the space. I think, yeah. I'm pretty confident in saying that, actually. Not that I've ever really articulated it like that before, but I think one is only possible because of the other.
You write about this idea of both and, which I really, really loved, and this idea that you can be quite busy and still have space, and this idea of mediocre space. And I loved this so much because I have, like many people, huge amounts of responsibility. I'm the only one paying the bills. I am the main person caring for my son, who has very high needs. Plus I have another child, plus, you know, just life, right? And I don't have an extensive family or anything around me. I used to get overwhelmed by this idea sometimes of slow living, a topic of which I have been deeply interested in my whole adult life. I mean, I was reading about, you know, I was reading like The Idler 20 years ago and stuff, and this idea of kind of, you know, living to live. But often it's talked about in a way that does feel inaccessible to some people, you know, in a really big way, space in a big way, profound, you know, leave your life and your community, go start somewhere new, quit your job, you know, all this sort of stuff. But actually, in my life, even with all my responsibilities, I can create space, and I do. I have to be quite fierce about it. No one's going to give it to me unless I demand it, but it is absolutely possible. And so I loved this idea of the mediocre space, because actually I have found there is actually so much of it. It's just that we often don't realize the choices we have day to day, because people, you know, will choose for us if we're not doing the choices ourselves.
Well, the space will fill up really quickly.
Mm.
And so as well as creating the space or recognizing the space, you actually have to, as you say, fiercely protect it. And I didn't want to write a book that was about overhauling your life, which is ironic considering my first book was all about overhauling my life. But, you know, 4 or 5 years now of settling into a home, kids in school, I am also the main breadwinner. So my partner has really stepped into that primary parent role for the past 4 to 5 years. So I could really charge ahead with my writing career. And I wouldn't have been able to do that without him. So he created that space for me. But after finishing my third book, it was a really massive undertaking. And I was really backpedaling from burnout at the end of it. And I just started to think about what I needed to be able to continue writing books, because I knew I wanted to do that. But I didn't understand my brain enough to have the answer then. And so I really started wondering, what does the brain need in order to continue to come up with ideas, to have the clarity, to be productive? Yeah, productivity is often frowned upon, but we do feel great when we have a productive day.
Mm.
But what does the brain need? And I'd spent the past, you know, 5 years heavily researching perinatal health. So I really put my health journalist hat on. So I was confident reading the studies. I was confident talking to specialists, and it kind of became my unofficial project, or I just thought, I want to better understand my brain as a writer. And I spoke to neuroscientists and psychologists. And it didn't take me long at all to realize that there's such a massive disconnect between the life our brain was designed for and our normal everyday reality. And that massive cavernous gap is, the question was, how do we bridge that gap?
Mm.
And it was so quickly realized that it's actually in breathing space. That modern life has eradicated breathing space from our lives, because we're always told to do better and be better. We're in this cycle of 24-hour consistency where we've got housing crisis pressure and cost of living pressure, and we're trying to keep up. We're always looking ahead. We're clinging to what comes next. We're striving for the next thing. We're hustling. All this language. And, you know, we talk so easily about burnout now, but we've completely eradicated breathing space from our vocabulary and our lives. And in these pockets of space that exist in our days, whether we're waiting for our kids at the school gate, or we're waiting in line for coffee, we're waiting for the kettle to boil, we are picking up a phone.
Mm.
And that's instinctive. That's not always a choice. Our brain always is looking for more, and our phones make that really easy.
Mm.
And in all those mellow states that are so rich and essential for creativity, so the waiting, the wandering, the strolling, the pottering, the pondering, they just all look like nothing, and so we don't value them.
Mm.
But they're just absolutely vital for our creativity, and we have to begin to revere and respect them if we want to continue to write efficiently and to get curious about an idea and to, as Charlotte Wood says, digging and diving for clues in the writing process.
Yeah, it's really interesting. One of the things that comes up quite a lot when I speak to other writers is this idea of, you know, writers, particularly newer writers, will say to me, but how do I know that I'm on the right track, that I that I'm going to end up with something if I follow, you know, this thing and I do all this work. And, you know, whether it's writing a book proposal or writing a whole novel or a whole memoir, before you know anyone wants it. For me, well, the answer is absolutely no one knows. No one ever, ever knows. And what we need is the ability to just recognize our own curiosity and trust in our own curiosity. And it's really interesting because I think that takes practice. But the only way to practice doing it is to listen. You have to be able to hear it. You have to be able to follow your own thoughts and to be able to hear it. And to do that, you need, there needs to be space in your life somewhere to be able to hear that thought and go, oh, I'm just going to follow that thread. I'm just going to follow it the next little bit along.
And I think that really requires us to turn down the outside volume because the world is loud. It is so loud. Social media is so loud. And we've kind of handed so much of our deep thought and our intuition over to phones and everything that's happening outside of us. But when you turn down that volume and you start to listen into yourself, which I actually think is a really vital part of the creative process, and I definitely don't do it well. And I've noticed that I still am buoyed by external validation in the form of like an email or a conversation with my publisher or anything like that. But I really am learning to kind of sit in what is, I think, the not knowing, which is a really scary place to be. And, you know, in my research, it became quite clear that so much of our modern stress is actually uncertainty stress. Like the brain hates uncertainty. And the writing industry is very uncertain.
Yeah. It's basically so ridiculously uncertain. And I think all creative pursuits are. But when you kind of add creativity to a kind of, you know, capitalist model, the two things coming together create ridiculous uncertainty. But what's interesting is you say you're not very good at it. But I think I don't know what we judge ourselves against in some ways, because I think it's always tricky. Paying attention inwards is always, I think it doesn't necessarily always come super easy. I don't think there's anything wrong with also needing outside stimulus and also
I think it's about actually getting to know yourself. And that's a part of the creative process that no one talks a lot about, but you actually do get to know yourself quite well.
Yeah.
If you sit with a project right through to the end, whether that ends in a publication or whether it ends in just a second or third draft that prompts you to start something else entirely. Like when you're sitting with the words and the page, you're also sitting with yourself.
Yeah.
And that's the confronting part. It's the vulnerable part. It's the joyous part. It's where you really, where you feel the tingles of something that feels really good. And so you follow that. And where you learn, I think, to sit with doubt and faith right beside you. And often, you know, it's not an equal balance between those two. One will really rear up higher than the other. But it's also about trusting that something will come from you sitting at the desk. And whether it's that, you know, resolute stubbornness that gets you through, or just that, you know, whimsical belief that you do have something to say and you want to be able to say it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it is a sitting with self. And in any spiritual or religious practice, that's the hard part, you know, the meditation, the silence, the quiet, the monkey mind trying to tear you away.
Yeah.
We're just learning to sit with ourselves. And I think it can also be, well, there's not, personally, I don't think there's any, there's no creative reward quite like writing a sentence where you sit back and go, yes. Like that is such a good feeling. And I will talk about this constantly, But the feeling when you complete a first draft, that is better than publication day.
Yeah, 100%.
And I've had 4 publication days now, and I still firmly believe that.
Yeah.
That you did it, that you carried yourself and the words and the page right to the end. And it's like no one needs external validation for that because you just did it on your own. It's such a good feeling. It is such a, it kind of resonates for a really long time as well.
It does. And you know, the other feeling I love is when you do get a finished book in your hands, just opening it and reading a part and going, oh my God, because you forget, right? You forget what you write. I do anyway. And I've spoken to lots of writers who say they forget what they write. Occasionally I'll have to go back to my first book, which is published like more than 5 years ago now, that for a talk or something. And I'll look at it and I think, oh, I wrote that. That came from me. You know, almost like when we look at our children and every now and then you're going to go, wow, they came from me. That is so mind-blowing. Like that is better than the actual publication day.
It's interesting that not remembering how the words got there. And I think that really proves that when you're sitting there with the page and the words are flowing out of you, that your brain and your body exist on completely. I've never spoken about writing like this before, but you've really prompted me to think quite deeply about this now. But just that, like, people that aren't writers are really shocked when I say, I don't remember writing this. Yeah. I don't remember how those paragraphs came together. I remember having faith that the threads would eventually connect, but I don't remember kind of bringing them all together. I don't remember how, in what order the words landed on the page. It is quite an esoteric process, isn't it? And you really just have to sit with it. And it also feels quite magical, the fact that you can go back and read something and go, huh, like that's actually not that bad.
Yeah, I know. It's a really interesting feeling. And what's so funny is that I think because as well, it can mean that, you know, I'm about to sit down and write something completely new because I just recently finished something. And, you know, there's part of me is just so excited, so, so excited. And part of me is also like, oh, but I don't know how I did it last time. Like, even though I know I did it and I've done it before, it's sometimes hard to explain that it doesn't magically mean that each time you sit down to a new project that you know exactly what you're doing and how you're going to do it, and that you're not also potentially a little bit overwhelmed when you sit down, which I find really interesting, because I think if you told me a number of years ago that feeling would not, I mean, it's changed a bit for sure. I trust myself a lot now in a way that I didn't used to be able to, because I just didn't have much experience. But it is just a feeling I just have to trust. I just have to trust that this is going to work out, rather than knowing. It's just faith rather than knowing. I guess that's what I mean.
I think that's the common thread in all of the writers' conversations I've listened to and all the writers I know, is that when you sit down to write a new book, you're writing a new book. It's not the book that it was that you wrote, you know, 2 books ago.
Yeah.
And you're also a different person as you sit down to write that book. And, you know, I don't think any book is easy to write, but I think there comes an ease out of that trust of knowing that you've done it before. I've worked quite closely with Charlotte Wood over the last few years, which has been such an incredible honour and privilege. And she's like the most humble person. She'll just roll her eyes, you know, if she hears me say this. But I just love how frank she is about, you know, the bloody work of it. Like, it's just work, you know, and some of it's really boring. And some of it's like, oh my God, I can't believe I've got to write this bit. Like, it's not all like flowy, esoteric, sparkly joy. Like, most of it is actually quite a grind.
But like, we keep going with the grind because we know at some point the flow will happen, and it's like drugs, isn't it? It's like, it's so worth
it. Yeah, it's that high. It's like, ooh. I'm actually writing, I'm about 40,000 words into my debut novel, which has been in my head for quite a few years, but nonfiction books with publishing deals have kind of taken priority, of course, you know, got to earn the money. And it's such a different process writing fiction to nonfiction. It is so different. I feel like with nonfiction, I can write a bit and step away and come back to it and step away. And with fiction, when I return to the manuscript, I'm having a break now because I'm in publicity mode and I just don't have the space or the time. But it will take me about a week to sink back into it. And I use that word sink so, what's the word? I use that word sink so deliberately because it's like I have to exist on a different plane to actually access the manuscript. I'm not sure if it's going to be like that for every novel, but here's me talking about every novel I'm ever going to write. But yeah, it's just been such a different process and my doubt is so much bigger.
Yeah. I have found writing fiction far more terrifying than writing nonfiction, which is funny because when I speak to non-writers and say, oh, it's like much scarier, I think non-writers don't really understand what I mean. But because the nonfiction that I've written is very deeply personal. And some people find what I've written, you know, they would find it way too exposing to write about my life the way I've written it about it in nonfiction. But I find fiction far more exposing, weirdly. It's like letting other people into your brain. That's what it feels like.
Wow, that is a fantastic way to describe it, and I wholeheartedly agree. And I think with my nonfiction, I'm very sure and certain of my voice. And if someone read any of my four books and then came across one of them somewhere else, I'm sure that they would pick up my tone. I believe it's very strong, and I believe it's in part why I have had, you know, the success that I've had, because people resonate with that tone and with that voice. And yet with fiction, I'm like, is this, hang on, no, I can't just...
It's a whole new voice to discover.
Hustling with myself. I'm like, what's you're like, and is it my voice or the character's voice? And like, is there barriers between the two? And there is so much thought about perspective and point of view and character and planning and plot. It's just, it's a much richer and deeper experience. And of course, it's going to be slower, but that slowness is also like, oh, like, what's wrong with me? Why am I only writing 300 words of fiction when I could have written 2,000 words of nonfiction? It is so vastly different. And I really wish that there were more stories of writers right where I am now, having nowhere near completed a first draft on their debut novel and just really like blindly making their way through.
I always love talking to writers that have switched genres or like write in multiple genres. I find it so fascinating because it's on one level, it's very similar, and on other levels, it's very, very different. And it's, I don't know, it's like, you know, it's got some similarities of craft for sure, but it's got a whole lot of additional ones fiction that nonfiction doesn't really need to use. But then there's loads of skills that we can take from our nonfiction writing and apply it to fiction writing, I think, as well. So it's just a really rich and interesting thing to talk about with other writers. I wanted to ask you about this idea that you write about in A Brain That Breathes. It's this idea of us all remembering that we are nature. And it was really interesting reading about that. It came up actually in my last book. I spoke to a psychiatrist and psychotherapist about this. And we were talking about it in the context of homes and this idea that as humans, we forget we have habitats. We think of habitats as something that only wild animals have, but humans have habitats too. And it's they have a huge impact, profound impact on our health and our well-being. And I have always found that reminding myself I am an animal has helped me creatively. I don't know, that might sound really strange, but reading it in your book was so nice to read, because I found that super helpful. And one of the ways in which I found it really helpful is this idea of reminding myself I'm not a machine. And that will mean that I need fallow periods and rest periods, because that is how nature functions. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. Like, how does reminding yourself you are nature help you as a creative?
I think I really can only write or access that elusive flow state if my physical body is grounded. And the fallow periods are so vital for productive growth. And even a flower, when it's growing upwards and outwards, will retreat slightly before it kind of comes into full bloom. And that's such a beautiful analogy for all of us, I think. And what I know about the brain now is that unless we actively declutter it, and unless we lean into rest, and unless we create breathing space in our days, and I'm not talking about like leaving your life, I'm talking about small pockets of breathing space in your life and doing everything that's normal and necessary as well, we just aren't going to be able to keep being creative. And yet the whole world is telling us that we should really be continually working, and efficiency is praised, and success is equivalent to achievement. And that's like, you know, we're teaching our children that from a really young age as well. And yet, just that simple, I am nature, I am not that different from a tree or a flower or a bird, you know, it's just such a potent, simple reminder. And as well as kind of living in tune with the seasons of the year, I'm such a big advocate for honoring the season that you're in. And, you know, that may be postpartum, it may be perimenopause, it may be divorce, it may be parenting a child with additional needs, it may be moving from one country to another. We can't actively remove ourselves from those seasons we're in, and we can wish all we want for us not to be in that season, but no amount of wishing is going to change the reality of that season. And I just really believe that we can access more creativity when we do surrender to where we are, and we really think about what is possible now, instead of like all the time I used to have, or all the time I'll have when XYZ is finished.
It's really interesting, isn't it? I think, and one thing I've talked about with writers I work with is the key to having time to write starts with acceptance. And it starts with really profoundly naming the constraints that you're living with out loud and on the page, and looking at them and accepting that is just how things are right now. And it's only by doing that, and then also, you know, at the same time, offering ourselves compassion at the same time for those constraints, whatever they might be. Sometimes they might be really profound, perhaps like a recent bereavement, you know, or something like that. And how those constraints can heavily impact on how we use our time. That only when we do that can we actually get on and use our time in that we do have. Because otherwise we get stuck in this friction of like being in one place and wanting to be somewhere else, and there's a massive gap in between. But only in acceptance can we kind of bridge that gap.
Yeah. And it's also about recognizing how beneficial small pockets of time are, and really recognizing and protecting your best hours or your best half an hour.
Mm.
And I think we can spend so much time as creatives, especially when it's not our primary profession or job, or, you know, and I don't really know any writers that are just making money off books. You know, there's not many out there. And so to be realistic, there's a lot of income streams and a lot of juggling. But I think we can spend so much time wishing for great swathes of time.
Mm.
You know, thinking, I'll write that novel when I've got that whole week. But I don't know about you, but if I ever go somewhere on a like writing retreat or something, like I kind of don't really get anything done.
Though, like, going away is the headspace.
Yes. That's
it's not necessarily for efficient productivity. It's for headspace if you can get it. But yeah, the idea, and I think this is why it's so important to have these conversations out loud, right? Because it's easy, I think, to assume that the writers who are publishing and who are perhaps publishing regularly, like you have done the last 4 years, that they have somehow magically just got way more time. But often it's not that at all. It's just choosing time to write over perhaps some other things instead. And that actually most writers I know are making difficult decisions about time all the time. And that there is a cost. And I think that's okay. I think it's okay to talk about the fact we are choosing to write over choosing some other things.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, you know, there is the currency of money and there is the currency of time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, our time is really valuable. And so we can kind of grasp for those minutes, or we can just surrender to where we are in life, and I think really carve out and protect those pockets of time that exist. And really, if you're in those pockets and the words aren't coming, I always suggest handwriting. Because it really slows down your thoughts a lot, and it can, I think when we're like sitting there like, okay, I've got 30 minutes, and sometimes the pressure of that time can really freeze us, I think especially when you're at the start of a project.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come away thinking, I just wasted that time. And it's such an awful, like, I know what that feels like as a mother to four children, that like I had that time and I wasted it.
Yeah.
No creative time is a waste because you're sitting there. But if you can handwrite, I think we should all be doing more handwriting. I really do believe, like, I start every book with a notebook handwriting, and I'm doing it at the moment, and it's such a fantastic way to really write without constraint and without judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we all know this morning pages idea, like, you know, it's been talked about, you know, everywhere. But I think we so easily forget that some of our best work, especially in that embryonic stage when everything is still quite tender and you're not really sure of it, and it's so good. And one of the best things I've ever been told on my writing journey was by the first person I spoke to at Murdoch Books here in Australia, Lou Johnson. And she said to me, I just want you to keep asking yourself, what is it? And so I really start every, I won't say every book, but I bring to every idea the question, what is it? Because I'm getting to know it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm trying to tease it out. I'm trying to let curiosity lead me. I'm trying to find connecting clues. And that's really is a head and a hands connection. That's not a computer thing.
Like, yeah,
you step away from that laptop.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps that slowness and that space, again, coming back to those two S's, is so vital for creativity, especially at the very beginning when you're really laying those foundations. And perhaps when time isn't abundant, Because you can have that notebook and pen in your hand, you know, in the kitchen or when you're on the bus or at the park. In all those places, it's so much more accessible.
Yeah, it's so true. It's really interesting, actually, when people also ask, how long did something take you to write? And it's a kind of almost impossible question to answer, I think, because it's like, okay, well, how long did it take me to physically get those? The last thing I wrote was 100,000 words. 100,000 words down, obviously, minus the 80,000 words that got cut in the process of writing those 100,000 words. But actually,
step to the side.
Exactly. But it was like the time you spend with your head in that project, when you're, for me, walking, I walk a lot when I'm writing, but doing the dishes, hanging out laundry, being with a child who needs a lot of support, you know, but my head being in another world, working on it, it is impossible to actually calculate how long something actually takes you to write. So the only thing I could tell people is when I started tentatively exploring an idea to when I kind of was like, right, okay, that is complete. And that's the only frame of reference I could give. I could never estimate how much time actually went. Like never in a million years could I figure it out. I don't know about you.
Well, it's invisible, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not a tangible quantity at all. And I feel like unless you live with a writer or unless you work really closely with a writer, you can never actually understand the depth of the process or the length of the process because there is so much of that carrying of the story that goes on in order for you to actually get it on the page.
Mm. You've wrote something which I really, really loved. I am, as you can tell from this conversation we're having, obsessed with time. I find it like endlessly fascinating as a topic and how we experience time. But you wrote about this idea of loosening our grip on time. And I love that phrase because it's almost like you do need to loosen your grip to let go a little bit of that idea of trying to control time to change how we experience it. And for me, that's been accepting that a lot of my writing happens away from my desk, partly because of necessity, but partly actually because it's a profoundly effective way of accessing creativity to be doing sometimes quite mundane things in order to be able to work away in my brain on something else. But yeah, that does mean you can't quantify it.
I actually wrote so much of A Brain That Breathes while walking as well. Because what I learned about the brain is that when we are walking, particularly without headphones, or when we're in nature, or when we're doing the mundane things around the house, so washing the dishes or standing in the shower and watching the water droplets run down the screen, our brain enters a mode called soft fascination, which is one of the most charming concepts I came across. And as soon as I discovered it, and as soon as I shared it with my writing group, and they all went, whew. And I was like, oh, this has got to move right up the front of the book because it really is as magical and mystical as everyone else seems to be thinking as well. And basically, when our awareness is lightly focused, so when we're outside and our awareness is moving from the cloud to the tree to the leaf to the branch, our brain essentially does the good work of decluttering. So all of the stuff we've soaked in kind of just gets sorted and there's space then. Our overwhelm is relieved. We're not so mentally tight. Thought threads untangle and we get ideas. And it's why writers always talk about coming home from a walk with an idea or the, you know, being able to solve a plot problem or having an aha moment in the shower. It's that process of soft fascination. And yet when we're on a screen, we enter hard fascination mode, which is a little bit like sirens in the street, like we can't look away. And there's an amazing meta-analysis that, sorry to reference Charlotte Wood again, but her book, The Luminous Solution, is fantastic. And as I said, I've worked closely with her, but she was really interested in how we bring our whole body to the page. And if we come to the page with anxiety and tension and doubt, that stifles our flow. And yet if we come to the page with an element of hopeful kind of optimism, even if it's very, very like, I'm just going to like, I'm going to come here today and think positive thoughts, even if it's that put on, that's really beneficial for our flow and our creativity. And so understanding this about ourselves, just as important as it is to understand that we are nature and we live according to seasons, and there's going to be some seasons where the words just aren't flowing and we're feeling tired and we just have to kind of nurture ourselves by perhaps reading and consuming inspiring art. And then there's going to be other seasons where we have that energy and that mental clarity to really be quite productive and efficient. The way we turn up every day to the page is just as vital as all that work on very intentionally clearing the brain and making sure that there actually is space. Like there's a, it's like we've cleared all the weeds essentially.
There was something you wrote around this, which is this idea of when you were talking about finding those gaps, which is this idea that gaps give us reprieve, and reprieve is profoundly hopeful. That was, I hadn't really sort of seen it articulated in that way before. But it suddenly, it really clicked for me, this idea of reprieve being hopeful and how that is so connected to how I often need to walk or do something physical to shake off things that might have happened in our household before I have time to sit down and write. The gap creates a sense of hope then when we sit down to actually do the work. I thought that was such a, it was so beautifully articulated why we need to preserve the gaps. And actually sometimes we might, you know, like we, like I was talking about earlier, so many of us can't get the big rest, the big space. But what we can get is the little gaps, and actually the gaps make all the difference. It certainly makes all the difference in my life. These little gaps make all the difference.
It's, you know, I define breathing space as small moments of downtime often. Just 2 minutes here and 5 minutes there and 10 minutes there. But you know what? When we are in those moments of reprieve, it's really hard to be okay with that if we're conditioned to think that our success is measured by our doing. And it can be really uncomfortable at first to sit in it and go, actually, it's okay just to be here for a while. It's actually really beneficial. This isn't nothing. It's actually, well, we know it's the proven antidote to stress, all those little bits of space. But it's actually so essential for our creative journey, and it does make us more curious thinkers, and I think it actually is hopeful because we learn to trust in the process, which isn't a clear-cut process at all, and it's not always charging ahead. As I said, it's you step one step forward and two back and perhaps one to the side. And, you know, any manuscript looks like that.
Yeah. Okay, so you've heard it here, guys. We are prescribing you gaps. It's essential. You have to do it. So there, you've been told. you're not skiving off, and you're not running away from work. It is an essential part of the process. I wanted to ask you a little bit about what it was like to come and resettle, because you mentioned earlier that you went on this 2-year trip where you got rid of most of your possessions with your 4 children. You resettled afterwards in Tasmania. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about that, because you also talk in the book about this idea of, you know, it's never done, right? This never work. We're as humans, as living creatures, we are constantly in flux. It's not like we can be like, right, this is exactly how I'm going to live now and stick to a routine. And I wanted to specifically ask you about that process of settling in and how I imagine it would have been quite easy to be swallowed up into a busy life again, not instantly, but over time, and how you sort of paid attention to not going back to a lifestyle you didn't want to lead, and to protect your time as a creative once you had all resettled and everyone was back in school again.
Yeah, it's such an interesting question because it is so easy, and yet it's so easy to be sucked back into that lifestyle. And yet at the same time, that lifestyle doesn't really exist overtly in Tasmania. And we knew that if we had have gone back to living just north of Sydney, which is where we came from, we would have immediately, because of the cost of living, been thrown back into full-time work for both of us. And if that had have been the case, I most definitely wouldn't have written 4 books in 4 years because there wouldn't have been the space for me to create. That sounds so cruel to say that, because I think for so many people, the cost of living and the pressures of normal life make creativity really hard. And I know here in Australia, we do not have artistic support like countries like Ireland does. And that the average income of an Australian writer is $18,200, which is well below the poverty line.
Yeah, that's, I'd say, almost identical to what it is in the UK, which I think is about, for book writers, about £8,000 or something. So very, very similar. Yeah.
And so this is the reality for so many creatives in Australia and obviously the UK. And so when coming back to your question about, I suppose, filling life back up, there was a period where life did feel unsustainably full. And I think it really coincided with my brain feeling really full from the work that I did on my third book, which, you know, the manuscript came in at 180,000 words. It was 65 interviews with health professionals. I was writing for the most sleep-deprived proportion of the population, new mothers, who are at their most physiologically and psychologically vulnerable. So I was very, very acutely aware of not wanting to put any judgment on the page. And I was discussing the most contentious topics in parenthood, which is birth and birth recovery and feeding and sleep. And so I had all these professionals saying to me, I'm glad it's you and not me writing this book. And I was like, well, I kind of curled up in a corner at the end of it and thought, no, like enough. Like this is silly. Like I can't keep doing this. And that's what prompted me to really consider what the brain needs. But at the same time, everyone, especially around me online, everyone is always talking about their overwhelm and their exhaustion and their burnout. And I was feeling like that even though I was living this slow, quite simple island life, I was still feeling that as well. So I was definitely not immune to that. But I think I also had the space to be quite quick in order and you know, get curious about, well, actually, what do we need? And really coming to that conclusion of breathing space and how vital it is for our brain, for our nervous system, and if we want to be creative and productive humans, which, you know, if you have a dream to write a book, you have to kind of lean into that. Yeah. And I also think, why aren't we talking about this? Why aren't we talking about how essential it is to actually declutter the brain? Because we all know what it feels like for our brain to feel full and stuck and overwhelmed and to have decision fatigue. and to think, I can't even hear myself think, you know, that's a really common experience. And yet we're not talking about doing the good work of decluttering the brain, which is actually a very simple, accessible, actionable and practical, you know, thing to do. And yet no one is making any money when we choose to potter or ponder or go for a walk.
I think this is so important to talk about, right? This idea that a lot of what you're suggesting in the book, and by the way, I want every writer to read this book, because I know the first part, you call the first part, what do we need to live? But I think it could easily be called, what do we need to write? What do we need to be creative? So I want everyone to read this book, because the things you talk about are all things, small, tiny things that we can do that have nothing to do with anyone else making money from us. You know, there's no apps that you have to buy. There's no subscription you have to pay for. As you mentioned, oh, this whole conversation has been sort of, you know, within the context of often we are all profoundly having to do a certain amount of paid work because of the cost of living. But sort of even aside from that, the work of this book, the thing, the suggestions, the kind of science behind it, no one is going to make money from these things. And almost there's a part of me, the real rebel, I have such a rebel side, that is a bit like, yes, no one's going to make money from me doing these things. It's actually kind of weirdly appealing to that rebellious side of me.
Well, like, no one needs another 10-step routine. You know, no one needs to, like, be told, if you do X, Y, and Z, you'll feel better. You know, this isn't about doing better or being better. It's actually just recognizing that biologically, we need breathing space in order to think clearly and to feel grounded and to be a well human. Like, this is a biological fact. And yeah, I just, it's so simple. And I think we're so overwhelmed and we're so exhausted that we think the answer is really complicated. And it actually could not be more simple and straightforward and actionable. And I think we've been conditioned to think that we really do need to, like, make plans for a whole month and, you know, do this and that. And it's actually, let's just focus on today. And I end each chapter with a five ways to create space or five ways to settle the nervous system. And I did that so that once you've read it, you can just choose one thing for today. And that is, like, that is my only prescription. Just focus on today.
Yeah.
Because tomorrow, sometimes even thinking that far ahead is a bit too much for any of us. And yet we can really learn to care for ourselves in incredibly meaningful ways. And I call it basic human care. I even hate the term self-care. I know it has really meaningful roots, but it's been totally hijacked by capitalism. It's a multi-trillion dollar global industry. A 10-step skincare routine is not going to solve your problems. It's not going to clear your brain. But if you take 5 minutes to wander around your local park without your headphones in, or if you make a cup of tea and sit in your chair and stare out the window and have a bit of a think, or if you lie with your legs up the wall and just take a few deep inhalations and let out five really releasing sighs, that is really meaningful care for your brain and your nervous system and your body. And you can do that right now.
I love that. I actually loved the whole thing about the sighing. I've been consciously sighing more since I read that section, because I remember I did it when I was reading it. I did. I'm like, oh God, yeah, it feels good. It feels really good, doesn't it?
Really good.
It feels really good to sigh.
And it's the body will naturally, or the brain will naturally prompt to sigh if you're very stressed. So we do it all throughout our day without even really realizing. But for me, when I was speaking to that neuroscientist, Dr. Jack Feldman, who's a professor of neurobiology at the University of California. He's such a lovely, charming man. And, you know, he was like, It's just your body letting go. It's your brain saying, hang on, we're a bit too tight now. And I really remembered my children after a bout of crying, you know, the
yeah.
And like I do that now, right now that I've done it, and I can feel that there's just a an immediate release. It's an immediate reset. And I think if we're tense at the computer, and it's like the shoulders drop, the jaw relaxes. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Jodie, thank you so much. Thank you for this book, by the way. It's just, it's so funny. It landed exactly the right time. I had a PDF. You sent me a PDF a little while ago, and I was trying to get to it. But then you were like, oh, no, I've got a physical copy you can have now. I was like, yes, amazing. I get to read a physical copy. And it arrived. And then as soon as it arrived, we went through the most profoundly difficult month. And it came to me at exactly the right time and reminded me of all these tiny things that can make life better when it's very overwhelming. So thank you very, very much. I really do honestly think this is a book that every creative needs to read, because I think what you're offering here in this book is just a reminder of how capable we are of accessing what we need as humans, rather than selling us more crap. So I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks so much, Penny. It really is the book I needed to write. But as so many people have said to me, it's actually the book they needed to read, which has been pretty heartwarming. So I'm glad it found you when you needed it too.
And thank you so much for chatting with me today. It's been so lovely to finally have a conversation with you after feeling like I've known you for years. So thank you so much.
Oh, my absolute pleasure.